and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by sustainable luxury travel writer and the sustainability editor of Condé Nast Traveler magazine, Julia Kinsman. Julia has been an authority in the travel world for over two decades as a renowned hotel expert. She's the co-creator and former editor-in-chief of the boutique hotel guide Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and went on to found Boutecho, a platform that helps hotel lovers find the best eco-conscious design-led hotels. And now she's releasing a book, The Green Edit, Easy Tips for the Eco-Friendly Traveller, all of which couldn't feel more pressing and relevant in our current global climate crisis. I hadn't met Juliet before this chat. We were able to meet in London in person a few weeks ago, and it's fair to say I found a true kindred spirit, albeit one I've got a lot to learn from as we all rethink the ways in which we travel. I really hope you enjoy her insight into the future of travel, as well as the wonderful array of unusual destinations that she picks for her travel diaries. So from Hungary and Transylvania to Newfoundland and Norway, let's hear now from Juliet Kinsman. Well, Juliet, thank you so much. Welcome to the Travel Diaries. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me and chatting.
It's my pleasure. I mean, I have to say, you are one of my most requested guests.
Wow, that's a great honour.
Yeah.
It's probably because people know that I have no filter. And I occasionally am prone to sharing an outrageous story or two.
So we can't avoid talking about, you know, what's going on right now. You're a person who is travelling nonstop. So how has it been for you these last few months? What have been some of the lessons that you've learned, perhaps, actually? Because as someone that does travel a lot, what has kind of risen to the top?
It has been an extraordinary time. And you can imagine, as somebody who specialises in sustainability and talks about how to use our travels as a force for good, by the end of last year, what with Fliegskam and flight shaming, I was really, really questioning how much I should be flying. So my last trip was to the Maldives last December, and I had thought, I am not going to fly much next year unless I really have to for work. But anyway, that was decided for me. And I haven't flown for, you know, in 2020, which is...
In 2020. Yeah. So that must be a complete, you know, one-off for you thus far in
life. You know, it's funny because I would have told you week after week during lockdown and during these strange times how grateful I was to be grounded, how I had felt the slowdown was really healthy and necessary, whilst I was lamenting the loss of revenue and industry for people on the ends of the supply chains all over the world who depend on long-haul travellers. Me personally, not, you know, leaving the ground and being at 35,000 feet and moving to different time zones, physically and mentally, I felt better for it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed being at home with my daughter, thinking about travel, thinking about how we can travel less but travel better. But do you know, in the very recent weeks, I've been tuning into podcasts, actually, and webinars. And when I hear someone talking from Mexico, or it was someone in the Maldives, and you hear those exotic tropical birds, something inside of me yearned to travel again. It yearned to be somewhere else, to experience different places and be reminded of why we travel. So I am missing travel.
Yeah. I actually wanted to get your opinion on something. So last year, as you say, flight shaming, you know, we were all thinking about flying less, being more mindful of that. But then we've become hyper aware during lockdown that 1 in 10 people work in travel and tourism, and the ripple effects of us not traveling. So how do we reconcile that? Not, you know, trying not to fly, but also then not impacting on these communities that need our tourist revenue?
I think the key word there is impact. And if we look at sustainability in terms of, it's not just environmental sustainability and how we interact with nature, it's social and economic sustainability. So we talk about low impact, reducing our carbon footprint. That's our negative, reducing our negative impact, reducing the amount of plastic that we use. Let's look at our positive impact. So in terms of travel, if we can all be a bit more mindful and responsible, and we can weigh up the pros and cons. So I believe, I've never been one to say, absolutely don't fly. I've said, be judicious, stop, think, discuss. That's kind of like my slogan. Which airline you fly with, are they one that, you know, it's more conscious about which fuel they use and what their emissions are.
And you can find that out just through a website like Skyscanner, right?
Actually, it's interesting you mentioned Skyscanner, because you're absolutely right. When you choose the route, it will have a sort of option that will show you the lower. Their algorithms are pretty limited. I'm a bit geeky, so you know, there's much more to that. It's more complex.
Yeah. That sounds, it's probably like it's quite top level.
It is, and better to choose the one. I think this is a great topic, and it's a reminder that we really need to take responsibility to think more deeply and research things. So there are some airlines that really are doing incredible things. They're investing in renewables. So you've got Finnair, you've got most of the Scandinavian, you've got Scandinavian Airlines, SAS, KLM is very good. So these airlines, not only do they reduce their imprint now, or their footprint, they really are thinking of ways to innovate. But it's about choosing a destination which will really benefit from your traveler money. So if you think, it's almost, I mean, it's been breaking my heart, to be honest with you, that all these places reliant on tourism just haven't had travellers. Can you imagine? So we see the images, all the monkeys coming, you know, all the monkeys returning to towns and parts of Asia because there's no tourists out in the forest feeding them. And that's kind of a sort of a reminder of how reliant they became on tourism. Was that healthy? Possibly not. Do those far-flung destinations have to rethink how they make money? Actually, yes. Maybe they shouldn't be so reliant on tourism. How can we help them? Can we look at our manufacturing and our industry so that we pay people better within those sectors? Can we look at this? I mean, I always get a bit geeky. You'll have to forgive me. So I always look at the big, much, much bigger picture.
Yeah.
And it's so complex. So I would always say, please choose a destination that will benefit from you leaving your money there. And then you have to look at who you're traveling with, and there's, you know, how much will stay in those local destinations, you know. And I think if you look at international chain hotels, not all of them, again, but they're really going to be concerned with making money for the owner of that property who might not live in that country, the asset owner.
Yes.
Right. And they will want to be making money for the management company. I won't shame any big luxury brands, but, you know, their bank account is probably not in that Southeast Asian or South American country. It's back on a registered offshore or in America, right? So what we want to do is look at local businesses. How can I, it's the same with everything. We think about it when we buy food or fashion. How can I buy something that I'm paying the absolute fair price for that is really helping that local far-flung community?
Absolutely. And we'll come on to that in more depth, because this is something that you cover in your new book. But we'll come on to that in a sec. First of all, let's begin your travel diaries, Juliet. Starting with chapter one, your earliest childhood travel memory. Where would that be?
You know, my first travel-related memory, it isn't somewhere we went to on holiday. It is somewhere we moved. I was 6 weeks old, you know. I think I was that small, from Canada. I was born in Canada. And we went to Algeria in North Africa. And now I don't remember anything about that time, because I was only there the first couple of years of my life. But what I do remember, and this is interesting, well, you know, the part of your brain that stores memory, your hippocampus, yeah? Lodged within that is your olfactory bulb that processes smell. So I don't remember anything from Algeria particularly, but I can tell you, if I smell a couscous or tagine made with North African spices, it takes me back. Honestly,
wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Amazing.
So my memory is one, it's like a scent memory or a taste memory. Most of our taste buds are in our nose, so they're connected, aren't they, right? So that is my earliest memory. And so I think that's why I have such a dear love for Morocco and those rich spices, because of that time.
And have you been back to Algeria since?
You know, I've never been back to Algeria, and I contemplated it a couple of years ago. Instead, I became friends with a sort of Algerian group of people in London where they would, I was the only non-Algerian, I'd hang out with them. They'd make all these, it was
the
such
honorary
fun.
Algerian.
Yeah. Because it is a bit difficult and complicated. And at that point, when I was hoping to go there, it wasn't ideal. But I have spent a lot of time in Morocco. And obviously last year, I crowdfunded and made a documentary about a charity called Education for All in Morocco in the Atlas Mountains. And I spent time with some families in Berber families right up in the villages. And that was a similar love. Honestly, people ask me what my happiest travel memories are and the richest moments. And they're not, you know, they're not these silver service affairs here or they're not these incredible luxurious privileged moments. Sitting in a little village, a little hut with this little girl on my lap playing with my hair, and her grandmother sat opposite me. We don't speak the same language at all, yet we somehow communicated, smiling and laughing, honestly. Mm. And she was called, oh, what was her name? It meant angel in Berber, I remember. Oh. And honestly, and it's that feeling, that connection, those moments. It's people connecting with people.
That sounds so powerful, and it's those powerful moments that really shape your memories of destinations often. And so you spent that time in Algeria, but then you spent a lot of your childhood also in New York, is that right?
Yes. So my father was a Canadian diplomat, career diplomat. So we moved from Algeria to New York. This is in the 70s. Wow, that was a different place to what it is now. Mm. And yeah, I think that really very much informed who I am growing up. I mean, albeit on the Upper East Side, I wasn't in such a gritty part of town.
Was being the daughter of a diplomat, did that instill in you a sense of wanderlust in the sense that that job is innately about travel and moving from place to place?
You know, I think some people, when they hear the word diplomat, will hear, you're right, they'll hear international. And it was my normal to move around, and the world and different cultures all mixing together was my normal. And I went to the United Nations International School. So my best friend, oh, hello, Mele Moala from Samoa, if you're out there. We haven't spoken for 40 years. But she, yeah, you know, that international.
The United Nations International. I didn't know that.
Yeah, UNIS. Wow. Yeah, it was right on the river, the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And wow, that was an incredible time. And they would do, once a year, they would do the school photo of everyone would come in their national dress. Mm. I guess I don't know. Mine would have been a Canadian Mountie, I guess. I wish I had those pictures still. this is before Instagram, where we did everything for photos. Yeah, it was an incredible time. So my normal was speaking to people. What a privilege. That is the privilege. Is seeing the world. There are 195 countries in the world. To meet people from those far-flung places is pretty incredible.
Mm. And so chapter two then is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
That is such a great question, isn't it? And when we talk about falling in love with, what do we mean? Is it aesthetically pleasing? Is it that it just sort of connects with us spiritually? And I would say again, that's New York City. That is New York City. New York, what I learned from growing up in Manhattan.
Yeah, how come you don't have a New York accent then?
You know, actually, there's an answer to that. I moved to England just before puberty. So if it's just before puberty, you adapt. That's what animals do. If it's just after puberty, I'd probably be sitting here with a weird Canadian New York accent.
New York fusion.
Yeah, I adapted.
So did you have one?
Oh, yeah. I've got to find those recordings for you sometime.
Oh, wow.
You should hear me. My mum used to make recordings of me telling jokes for my grandparents in Buckinghamshire, which we'd send, but I've still got those. They're really, really funny.
So what was it that you loved about New York?
So, and I think this, as I say, I absolutely think this is what informed me and who I am today. And it was a struggle in my teens in a boarding school in Somerset because I was different to other kids for this reason. When you grow up in New York, you believe in talking to each other, strangers. You sit on the subway, you talk to the person, hey, how are you? You talk to the person next to you. You're not shy to voice your thoughts. It's not disrespectful to say, I don't have that same opinion, let's exchange ideas. It's a different way of being.
Yeah.
And I know I can be pretty full on for a lot of people in my thoughts. You see the funny side. You absolutely don't just celebrate. You don't know any way but being individualistic. I don't mean in the selfish sense. There's that, definitely. I mean, you're not afraid to be different. You are who you are. You know, we prize individualism. and dressing the way that you want to dress.
It's quite in contrast to British expression as well.
And certainly great. Then being eventually, you know, spending my teens in the burbs in Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I can't tell you. That was. I mean, this is like a therapy session. Thanks. I'm realizing why it was such a struggle for me in my teens, because it's two extremes. I mean, yeah. you have a big connection with New York or America.
My dad also is a New Yorker. So the way that we would deal with confrontation would be to fully express how we feel about something, you know, articulate it, shout about it, and then move on from it. So I think that hasn't necessarily done me that many favors, you know, with my British friendship group, because that's just not really how we address things.
Totally. And so my friends can be slightly in awe of how I'll suddenly be very, really powerful. Like I'll be dealing with the cab driver who's taking the mickey or something.
Yeah.
Or they can just be like, oh goodness, tone it down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's embarrassing for English people.
I'm
right?
Definitely embarrassing sometimes for English people.
Same. We obviously both are. So do you go back there a lot to New York?
So, you know, I've been back there a couple times a year, always.
Oh, really? So that's a lot.
Yeah, but then I have to say, when a certain person, that January, when a certain person got in, president, that January, I flew to New York that day. I'd been on the march in London and I got there just in time. It wasn't planned, but it happened to be. Something felt a bit different. It just felt a bit different in New York. The New York I knew and loved felt different. And I haven't been back there recently. I should be there now. I usually spend summers in the Catskills. You know, it's a country full of amazing people. 350 million people. I'm a bit shocked they couldn't find some better candidates out of 350 million.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, that's complex. The media and all of these things, it's complex, just like sustainability.
So are you a big AOC fan?
I absolutely love her. I mean, what a great moment. Can you believe she's in her 20s?
She's so inspiring, and she makes me feel like I really need to do some more things with my life. I mean, she's just so incredible, and I hope she'll be president one day.
I absolutely do. You know, it's interesting, your response is, she makes me want to do more things with my life. My response when I saw her was, how powerful language can be when it's respectful, when it's inspiring, it's not negative. You know, she just was so... She responded to such a terrible situation. Please, if you haven't seen the clip of her talking in
Congress.
It was in, of course, she's a congressman, in Congress about Ted Yoho, was it? Yeah, and just calling him out for calling her, I mean, seriously, whatever. It's so powerful, and it's we need to speak to each other with respect, always, and think and have open conversations.
Something that translates so clearly into travel as well, you know?
Absolutely.
Again, it's just about connecting, isn't it?
It is, you know, and I think it's no coincidence that during this time, obviously, we've been talking about the virus, but we've been looking at society. Black Lives Matter was a really, really important conversation. And I think that reminds us in travel, not just to, you know, speak up about diversity and inclusivity. Of course, that's so important. But actually, Trevor Phillips is a friend of mine who I interviewed him for Condé Nast Traveler. And he expressed it to me so perfectly. He said, when we look at travel, let's not look at it as a way of exploring different worlds. Let's not look at those far off destinations. You know how often they're marketed as a whole new world, it's incredible. It's not a different world. It is the same world. Mm-hmm. And those people in those places are also human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same as us. Actually, let's not look always at our differences. Let's celebrate those and let's explore those and understand those. But let's remember that we are all the same. We are all members of the human race, and we have the same desires, and we have the same hopes for our family and the same needs.
Yeah. Well, that leads me on very nicely, actually, to chapter 3, which is the place where you learn the most about yourself.
So the place where I learned the most about myself, as it happens, it feels like such an almighty cliche before I qualify it, Bali. So it sounds all eat, pray, sleep. Eat, pray, love.
Eat, pray, love.
Sleep. That says everything about me, doesn't it? That's so funny. In that book, I have to tell you, I was like devoured the eat bit. And then I was like, anyway, I didn't love the book. But the reason it happened, so just over three years ago, I moved to Bali with my daughter so she could go to the green school and learn about sustainability. What an incredible experience. So we went there. I got a villa. And for whatever reason, that time away really made me think about what mattered to me. And I dealt with some things. It was the 30th anniversary of my mum's death. And I remember I cried nonstop for 3 days, probably for the first time, because I never dealt with it at the time. So there was that. So that was...
You must have been very young.
I was almost, how old was I? I was 13.
Oh, what an awful
not
age.
Ideal. No. Not ideal. And it was very sudden. And so I sort of processed that. And I realized what I needed and wanted. And, you know, my husband, Kitty's dad, came to visit us. And we agreed that perhaps spiritually we didn't have that connection. It wasn't quite right. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big change. Yeah. In my life. And so it was a big learning. So you say learning to who I was, what I was about, that was profound. But it wasn't, you know, Bali is a spiritual place. If you stay out of the all night, you know, the bars and the it's everything. It's the best and worst, just like so many places.
So do you think there was something about Bali that gave you a kind of awakening in a kind of greater sense with these relationships, both past and present?
You know, definitely. I feel like the sitcom of my life could be called Something About Bali. That's so funny. Now, I had lots of conversations, as you do in Bali, about whether it's the actual, you know, is it the geology of the island? What is it about that place? Personally, for me, as I said to you, I'm really drawn to these very green environments and landscapes. And sitting there's nothing that pleases my soul more than watching the sort of paddy, the bright Kermit the Frog green paddy fields swaying, and that you just feel connected to Mother Nature, I think.
And so I read some of the articles that you wrote about that time. You didn't sugarcoat it. There was both highs and lows of being there. So would you recommend it, first of all?
You know, I'm always reluctant to really ever offer advice in these big life-changing things because it's so personal. I'm going to tell you, first of all, my daughter, it was a great experience, and I know that maybe not always in the moment will she recognize why it was so enriching. It will be in the retrospect. She couldn't wait to get back to London, to a desk and a much more conventional, traditional way of learning. She loves her school. We love London. I love knowing that when I leave the house, how long it's going to take me to get to the next place, and I won't arrive dripping with sweat. Yeah. You know, it's different for different people. Mm-hmm. If you have a child perhaps that isn't so good at learning in the conventional way, I'm sure it's incredible. And I have so many friends who loved it, and I made lifelong friends there.
What does it involve, just on a kind of in a nutshell? How is schooling different there?
So that's a broad question, and let's first of all just picture it. It's made of bamboo. It is an open-air bamboo cathedral. We actually even sang. They would sing in assembly every week. Green school, the bamboo cathedral.
Wow.
Sounds culty, right? And it was amazing. And you'd have all these fun people. You'd have someone from the Beastie Boys doing a talk, or you'd have this YouTuber from India doing a talk. Wonderful, inspiring. My friend Bandana Tiwari, who is a sustainable fashion expert, she's a great person who's part of that community. I was going through a difficult time for me, and I think I wanted a bit more conventional structure. And what I work well, and I sit at a desk in working hours on my laptop, and that's much more for free spirits, I think. Also, being a single woman, you're not always welcomed into social environments in the same way. People, and there's a lot of couples who've gone there on a sort of family gap year situation.
Yes,
and I'll tell you what else, they're all loaded, and I am not. I'm a normal person, so it wasn't about keeping up with the Joneses. It's much more expensive to do something like that than you imagine.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you think about Bali as somewhere that, you know, the food must be really cheap, or, you know, I've not been to Bali actually. So it looks wonderful, and it's a place I hope to go to one day. When I get there, what should I do to experience the real Bali?
So the Balinese people, as with everywhere, you know, some of them are so kind and wonderful and invite you into their home, and it's a spiritual experience. I think something like 80% of Balinese people are Balinese Hindus. So that's a wonderful way of being. They have things called Chenang saris everywhere. They're offerings to the gods. And it's, you know, these, which are comprised of different colored flowers or bougainvillea. And you see the women carrying them on their heads and in their brightly colored saris, and the men too. Yeah. And they have these ceremonies and rituals all the time. It's incredible. But the other side is it was absolutely chock full of tourists and you are sitting in traffic jams. That does not feel tropical. Bali needs to recalibrate. It had too much mass tourism. Mass tourism is not good. I do not advocate that. And that sounds very elitist and I don't mean to, but the fact is we need less people to travel, spending more money when they do. Just for environmental reasons, impact reasons. Mm. And Bali had way too many mass tourism. People just trying to make money.
And there are different pockets of Bali that are very popular. So as someone who knows it so well, are there parts of the island that would benefit more from our tourist money than the typical famous places?
So I think when I... How do you picture Bali in your mind's eye? What are you picturing?
I'm picturing rice paddy fields stretching far beyond me and poodling along on a bicycle through them, maybe ending up in a windswept beach. And I also picture lots of Instagram girls in kind of hot pants drinking a really nice coffee.
I'm giggling a bit here. You're so right. In Canggu and all around the south, I'm afraid that whole Instagram culture, it is a bit, you know, the cut off denim shorts and the girls with the big hats coyly looking behind them over their shoulder. Yeah, it is that. So Bali is lots of different things. And just like anywhere in the world, you know, if you go to the really obvious tourist spots, the thing with that is you're hanging out with other foreigners and tourists, which isn't why I travel. But if you go more to the east side, It is what you described, actually, those paddy fields rolling into beach. But Bali actually isn't about the beaches as much as people think. For me, it is, I love being right in the heart. Ubud, again, is historically has become very, very touristy. So many people, you can't move, especially the Instagrammer brigade. But if you just if you stray to the north of the island, I've never been to the west, I'd love to, you will have these incredible experiences where there aren't many other tourists. I think it's just about doing your homework. I mean, I love going to Bali and then you hop over to somewhere called Sumba. Do you know Nihi Sumba?
Yeah, heard of it? It's been mentioned a few times on the podcast, actually. I mean, a place where it seems to really have an impact on people, again, spiritually.
Yes.
And also a lovely hotel, the Nihi Sumba.
Well, Nihi, yeah. Well, Claude, who created that with his wife Petra back a long while ago, what they also did at the same time was create a foundation and a charity. So it's incredible what they did. That's got a sort of staggeringly exciting surfing wave and beach. That's part of the allure. As an island, the actual sort of geography isn't as interesting, actually. It's not as green and lush as Bali. Mm-hmm. So again, it's about why you're going. What are you going for? Who are you connecting with?
It's a kind of a hop away from Bali, is it?
So, yeah, it's if you get on a small flight, you can go to Sumba, which is further east, or you could go to Lombok, which is the next island over.
Oh, yeah. You've heard There's of so much to see in that part of the world in Indonesia, isn't there?
There is. I mean, Indonesia is an archipelago of, what is it, nearly 17,000 islands or something like that.
Unbelievably huge.
Yeah. I worry about Indonesia because of this time. I mean, they were so reliant on tourism. I also worry about the fact that they're... If it isn't tourism, you know, they we know about palm oil and all of the way their industry is pretty intense. And do they really think about the bigger picture? I don't know. I think it's about looking at where you're staying and who you're giving your money to, and are they having a positive impact?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Juliet has brought the crucial importance of sustainability travel to light. We all love to go on wonderful holidays, but it's our responsibility to make sure we protect the planet while doing so. Thankfully, the team at Turquoise Holidays work with a number of hotels and resorts who all share that eco-friendly vision. There's no limit to the innovative ways in which they're willing to protect the environment, whether it's implementing reef restoration programs in the Maldives or replacing energy-intensive aircon with natural airflow in the Caribbean. Being a family-run company, Turquoise Holidays wants to help protect the beautiful destinations it sells and work with partners who do the same. Head over to the Turquoise Holidays website and their Instagram account to find out more about their eco-friendly expertise and how you can make your next holiday a sustainable one. And kind of going back a little bit to your Mr. and Mrs. Smith days, James Lawn was one of my guests on season one, and I love also Smith Hotels, looking at their curated collection. And that was something that you really spearheaded, wasn't it?
So with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I'm so glad you spoke to James. He's such a, he's such a affable guy.
Oh, he is.
I had this idea to do a guidebook. And because they felt that no one was really identifying the type of hotels that we, at that point, sort of style conscious professionals might want to stay in at the weekends. We didn't want to end up in chintzy, fusty B&Bs.
Yeah.
You know. Certainly their idea. And I was thrilled that they approached me to look at the sort of storytelling part of it, as we would say now. And what we wanted to do was create a really irreverent human voice, like it might be a friend. Actually, so it was actually called Mr. and Mrs. Smith in terms of that was the, you know, obviously it's a wink to the expression when you're going away for a dirty weekend, a cheeky weekend, yeah. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And it was, yeah, a phenomenon. So it's a Smith Hotel became a genre. And then I sort of, you know, it was wonderful, but then I sort of was noticing these hotels that have are beautiful looking design hotels, but they have this positive impact, the sustainable hotels. And no one was really identifying those a few years ago. So that's why I created Boutico as a platform, to spotlight those hotels.
And what are some of your favorite hotels on Boutico?
So without a doubt, they'll also, you know, initially there will have been hotels that I fell in love with through Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So I went to Fogo Island on my honeymoon. Yeah.
Fogo Island. Oh, yeah. Wow. So tell the listeners a bit about that.
So Fogo Island in Canada. When I'll continue the theme of mentioning my dad. So I said to my dad, who's from Canada, so dad, I've booked our honeymoon. We're going to Newfoundland. You're going where? It was the easternmost point of Canada. It is not glamorous. It is quite sort of rugged. It's not somewhere you would imagine a sort of somebody who was interested in the high life or fine living would go and spend their time. But thanks to Zita Cobb, she created the ultimate sustainable design-led hotel in Fogo, her community, to create an economic engine for a community that had, that basically it was of fishermen, and they had, because of the sanctions on fishing in the early 90s, they had no economy. So she very cleverly positioned it as a luxury destination. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, you know? And I mean, it's so hard to get to. I'd encourage anyone listening, if you don't know Fogo Island, to maybe look it up on Instagram and look on Google Images and see what it looks like, because architecturally it's something else. So what's it? I mean, I've not been there, so I'd like, tell me more about it.
So Fogo Island Inn is what I love in a hotel. It's beautifully crafted. It, of course, it's aesthetically pleasing. Of course, the food and drink is wonderful. But the fact that, you know, Zita Cobb, who created it, always talks about economic nutrition. So the fact that, you know, your money is going to a good business where they pay their staff properly, where it's staying in the local community and really helping them. It's an absolute exemplar of the concept of the triple bottom line, which means it's good for planet, good for people. And yes, you know, it's a for-profit business.
When we're talking about these different hotels, it's clear that the main consideration is the environment here and the sustainability. But do you ever pick a place because it's going to be really luxurious and comfy? Like, how does that inform your choices? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I want to be comfortable just like the next person.
Yeah.
I want to be surrounded by beautiful things.
Are both equally important? How do you strike the balance?
So how do we strike the balance? It's funny because actually if we look at design, the concept of design really by definition is humans finding solutions to problems through design. So I love quality. I love that sense that a human being has crafted a beautiful piece of furniture out of natural materials, and perhaps it's given someone who for generations the artisanal skills have been passed down, so it's social and cultural preservation through what they're doing. I should say social sustainability and cultural preservation through allowing that artisan to carry on doing what they're great at. And so any hotel which looks beautiful but is also having a positive impact, that's the holy grail for me. It just feels better.
Right.
It just feels better.
And so can you tell me about a couple of others?
In terms of hotels that have used style and design to have an incredible impact on their local communities, Ushua, so it's spelled UXUA. So what Wilbert Das has done there...
This is in Brazil.
And what he has done in Trancoso, what was a tiny fishing village, is he's acquired all these little casas and he's converted them. But he's also had all these incredible artists in residence. They're using all natural materials in the local area and turning them into works of art. And, you know, that's rather than ordering a sort of shipment of furniture made in China, right?
Yeah.
This is an incredible thing to do.
Yeah.
It's what we talked about, what I love about being a New Yorker. You know, it's individual. It's not afraid to sort of stand out, do things differently. Ushua is a great exemplar of that. Katamama, well, actually, Potato Head, Desa Potato Head, it is. It's just opened in Bali. Ronald Akili behind that. He employed loads of Indonesian artists and artisans to craft an incredible hotel. And actually, that's a lesson in fantastic forward-thinking architecture, which is converting waste into art, often, you know, upcycled plastics, ocean-captured plastics, and things like that. It's imagination. What we're talking about is a great imagination.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, speaking of favourites, Chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination. Where would that be?
So I have so many, and I'm fickle, but one that will always stand out. And, you know, I mentioned how in Bali, you know, it was a milestone in my life. Well, another milestone was the most wonderful wedding that we did have in in Budapest in Hungary.
So what made you choose to get married in Budapest?
Well, actually, my mum had spent the time living there back when it was communist. And she had worked for the British consulate. And I know that she secretly was always trying to organise parties between Hungarians and British people. I guess maybe so it's in my genes that I always want to connect people. And so I had an affection for that from her. Also, I love wine. Like, I'd tasted Tokaj wine. It's a dry white wine, or it can be a dessert wine. I said, I need to get married. I need to get married in Hungary so we can have this wine. It's going to be a lot cheaper there. And I love Brody House. It's everything we've talked about. Imagination, upcycled furniture, bright colour. Artists have created that.
So is Brody House a hotel?
Brody House is a hotel. They also have a members club called Brody Studios. We were the first wedding in there. It's an incredible property. And the food and drink in Hungary is absolutely delicious. So I love to correct people's incorrect preconceptions often.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it looks like such a beautiful city. It's one that I would really love to go to. If I go there, what would you suggest that I do? What are some of the best things to do in Budapest?
So in terms of, Budapest, well, there's Buda and there's Pest.
Yes.
Yes. So Buda is on one side of the Danube and Pest, I think they say Pest, is on the other. So Pest, where Brody House is, was historically, you have the Jewish quarter there. It was much more, it was more sort of working. It was less refined as the Buda side was much more the sort of aristocracy side.
Yeah.
I love Pest. And I love, there's just so many of these things called ruin bars. Oh, everyone has to go to a ruin bar. So they'd be open air.
Yeah.
Good in these times, right? And they look kind of bombed out. But they've made them into really quirky pubs. Yeah.
Oh, they sound amazing. So let's now chat a little bit more about the Green Edit, easy tips for the eco-friendly traveller, which is out soon, written, of course, by Juliet. And the book is broken down into kind of, would you say, two main chapters? So it's about kind of holiday planning and while you're away, right?
Yeah. So thank you. Actually, Ebury came to me to do the book in January. And so I had my own, I was in lockdown in February in quarantine writing a book.
Anyone who writes a book is just in their own kind of lockdown.
Totally. And they wanted something that was very sort of practical, not necessarily for someone who'd already considered being the environment or being a sustainable traveler, but someone who really didn't know where to start.
Yeah.
So it was, we wanted it to be helpful and just practical, user-friendly tips. And in terms of, for me, I mean, travel is so many different stages. There's the dreaming, there's the inspiration, then there's the booking and the trying to get a good deal, do the right thing, all of that. Then there's the going.
Yeah.
Which is all packing up and all of that, again, another, you know, it can be complicated or not. And then it's being away. How do you have a positive impact while you're away? How do you, all the things I've talked about, you know, how do you make sure that your money's going to the right people, staying and really helping that destination? And then it's the memories, actually. It's the knowing that you've had a positive legacy in a way. It's the coming back and thinking, wow, I really helped people whilst through having a holiday.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So let's kind of think about some of those elements. Deciding where to go. I just wondered if you could maybe recommend to us a couple of ways that we can avoid over-tourism, places that we might have on our kind of travel wish list that actually maybe we should avoid for now, and some of that might be a good alternative.
One of the best things you can do is say to your friends, where have you been that isn't an obvious place to go to that you would really recommend and give me some tips? Because your friends are likely to share your taste. But for me, if I were to recommend where you go, so don't go to Venice. They have no shortage of tourists. They don't need us. But you could go to Treviso, which is just across, you know, it's just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And what I love, I'll tell you my favorite little fact about Treviso. We all know tiramisu.
Yeah.
That comes from there. Because it means pick me up when translated. Yeah, I love it. From Treviso, when all the ladies of the night would, on their very busy Saturdays, about 3 a.m, they'd need a pick me up. And so there'd be a cafe in Treviso, which would make them the coffee, the cream, the sugar, little pudding that they would have and be able to get back to work.
That's amazing. I love that. And really, this is, in a way, considering hidden gems as places to maybe go. So that leads us on to that chapter, your hidden gem. What would your hidden gem be?
I love the alpine views, just those, we've talked about that, these incredible lush green mountains. Well, actually, for me, for that, Transylvania and Romania. Still some of my friends, no matter how many times I recommend it, they can't, I don't know what they have in their mind, but they can't get their heads around Transylvania and Romania being one of my favorite destinations and a hidden gem. And I went there last summer with the Slow Cyclist, a group of really, really great people. And we were cycling through this area. It's so beautiful to look at. And the food and drink, again, was excellent. And so, you know, it doesn't get the same attention as, say, Tuscany in Italy.
But would you make a comparison in terms of the way that it looks?
I actually would, but it's a different type of architecture because you've got the Saxon villages. And I
Which must be amazing.
It is. The history it's absolutely palpable. I mean, it's a complex history and not always such a heartwarming sort of situations. But Copșamare, which is centuries old, little tiny pastel coloured houses there, is incredible. I mean, for us, it's from a fairy tale. It's like as though Disney was channeling that.
Really?
Yes. And everyone is still, there's lots of people. We were cycling on the roads, there's not so much, there weren't cars passing us, but horses and carts. I mean, it's of a different time.
So in contrast then, chapter 6 is the worst travel experience that you've had. I mean, you've traveled a lot, so there must have been some less positive experience that you've had over the years.
I think what we've learned through this time really is it's often through the most difficult times that we learn the most. So I always try to look for the silver linings, but there's one particular travel experience I had where I was really struggling to see the learning. It was a few days before Christmas. My daughter, I think, was only a year old. There'll be mum's gasping. I was there for work. It was, I think, my first long haul trip away. And it was also hurricane season, I think, in the Caribbean. And I'd gone there. It's not about the destination. I can't remember if it was Grenada, St. Lucia, or Antigua. Maybe Antigua. Anyway, we had all queued up to get on the plane. We're looking at the plane and we watched that mobile staircase, you know, the ground support machine that gets you up to the plane. We watched it drive into the plane, penetrating the metal, puncturing the metal. We all just watched it like jaws, thinking, we're not going to be able to get on that plane now. Like in slow motion. And we couldn't. So we were all bussed off to the most terrible, terrible hotel. And it was terrible weather. So we didn't get another day at the beach or anything. And it was, you know, grey skies. And my room had the most gigantic cockroaches. Honestly, I see handbag dogs in Notting Hill smaller than those cockroaches. So that was probably my worst one. But hey, you know, it's a great story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. For all those kind of things, it's always a story to tell on the other hand, isn't it? So how are you feeling about traveling again? Are you thinking about going on a plane soon?
I am thinking about travel. I'm really enjoying the fact that we're taking much longer to think about where we're going and why and planning it. And I've been looking at Norway and thinking about that's the next time I'll get on a plane. I'm really looking forward to exploring Norway on a little road trip. And I'll probably go on my own. I love traveling on my own. I really, really do. And I've listened to your podcast and I loved the one with Giles Corran. And he rightly sort of referenced how we get to go to these luxury hotels for work. And it's a bit of a shame because we can't share it with someone.
Yeah.
But actually, because I focus on the sustainability side of it and finding out stories about the good they're doing, when you're on your own, you step out of your comfort zone and you have much more meaningful connections with strangers. And so I know that will happen in Norway. I can't wait. So that I'm planning. And it's closer. It's not a long flight.
So what parts of Norway are you hoping to visit?
So I'm going to start in Bergen. And I think, you know, I've always loved that. Again, I love those brightly coloured houses there. I've always been drawn to these sort of fjord landscapes, the water, the pine trees around it. I want to meet the Sami, the indigenous people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's another part of the sort of circuit I'm planning. And indigenous people, I can tell you, if anyone's suffering from these times, it's the indigenous communities all over the world, from Australia to Amazon. It's heartbreaking. So again, looking at how we can support them for so many reasons is really important.
Yeah. So is that your next big adventure, chapter 7? Or have you got something planned more imminently?
My next big adventure is in Scotland. I'm so excited. It's a road trip.
Wonderful. Where in Scotland are you going?
Three little girls, two mums. one mini car.
All in one car?
Mini adventure. All in one car, me driving.
Wow.
Lots of podcasts. Yes, I'm driving. I booked somewhere to stop in the Yorkshire Dales on the way. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to various different places in Scotland. And I booked a cottage through Canopy and Stars. Do you know them?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's part of Saw Days. And I'll tell you what I love about Canopy and Stars, going back to looking at businesses being good businesses. They're B Corp registered. Do you know about that?
No.
So B Corp is a sort of accreditation system where you have to prove you're a good business.
Oh, right.
Yes. And so I love that about booking through them. And we're going to be in nature. And then I'm going to end up in Allerdale.
I thought that I saw you going there.
Yes.
Oh, I'm very envious.
Which I think is the top of a lot of travel writers in the UK's list right now. Now, especially when we can't go abroad. You know, we always think we have to go on safaris to far off different continents, and actually Allerdale's got wildcats, and it's the biodiversity is incredible, and biodiversity is everything, as we know, in sustainability. So I can't wait.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'll be following you on social media and seeing your wonderful trip. That sounds fantastic. Well, I can't believe that we're on to your final chapter. That's chapter 8, which is what is at the top of your travel bucket list.
I love thinking about this. I kind of hate the term bucket list. I mean, I know it's, we talked about the sort of influencer or Instagram culture, and I felt that there had become a culture where people did things to show it off on Instagram rather than how it made it feel.
And we're all guilty of that, right?
We're all guilty of that.
I mean, I posted a photo of me in the Maldives with a floating breakfast not so long ago, you know? Like,
been there, done it.
Right, exactly.
Got the gram. Yeah. Oh dear. Yeah. Look, we're all guilty of it. It's absolutely true. But I guess what does bucket list comes from? Kick the bucket, does it? The things we want to do before we kick the bucket.
Yeah.
Is that what it means?
But we can also look at it as a travel wish list.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say part of me, I always wanted to go to Japan, but I sort of, I delayed it because I thought once I've done it, then I've done it. So part of me really yearns to go to the Peruvian Andes, mm-hmm. not Machu Picchu, because I know that's somewhere that suffers from over-tourism. But Anna Hunt, she is a Peruvian-trained London-based shaman. Different people say it differently, shaman. But I did anthropology, as did you.
Yeah. Yay. We both did social anthropology at university.
Yes, and we did, that was one of the...
Oh, shamanism was a really important part of that, yes. Oh,
and what does a shaman mean to you?
A form of a spiritual healer, I suppose, that's based in an indigenous culture. Is that how you would...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I pretended to be really gracious asking you to do that, but I knew you would say it better than me, so she did. Yeah, so she is that, and people might roll their eyes. I used to roll my eyes at anything to do with spiritualism, actually. But you know, when you look at it almost in a scientific way, and you think about the rural Peruvian communities and the wise elders in the Amazon rainforest, they are totally connected to nature because they have to be. They have to understand the weather systems and be intuitive, because if their crops failed, they have no food. So those instincts, we lost them as a race. You know, as we think we become so advanced and sophisticated living in our cities, we became further detached from nature. And I think that's what this time has taught us.
Yes.
I really think this time, these months, and looking at a virus and coronavirus, whatever conspiracy theories you hear or whatever you think, the fact is human beings have moved away from being in harmony with nature.
Yes. I completely agree with you.
I think, again, as I said, it's about being scientific and logical. It's about thinking we are animals. We are organic creatures. It's only natural that we should be connected to the environment, right? Mm. So I would love to go to the Peruvian Andes with Anna Hunt, who she wrote a great book. Now, I don't love the title, and she knows that. It's A Shaman in Stilettos. It's a bit of a goop ilk, right?
Right.
But if you spent time with her... And I did actually do a retreat with her in London just before lockdown. Maybe mm-hmm. that's why I survived it. And it's really reconnecting with yourself. It's about energy. And I can't even attempt to try and explain it here. But when you do experience it or speak to someone, it's about tuning you in to the earth we live on. And actually, that is logical when you hear it from a master.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I hope that you get to go there sometime soon and we can hear all about it. It sounds absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Juliet. Those were your travel diaries. Such a fascinating chat, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for letting me just share some stories, and I love chatting to you. Thank you.
Well, that was the lovely Juliet Kinsman. So many great tips to help us all understand how to satisfy our wanderlust in the most eco-friendly way. Her new book, The Green Edit, is out on September 10th and is available for pre-order now. If you liked this episode, why not subscribe and get new episodes weekly? You can do that for free on all the podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, and Castbox. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. And for everything else podcast related, visit thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.